Hello and welcome. This is Louder Than Words, the pod that's all about ideas that improve lives. I'm Jules Pretty. In this episode, we're talking about Indigenous people and cultures, their wondrous story lands, the continuing threats to their life ways, their rights to live the ways their cultures choose, how good and bad sit side by side for 500 million people across the world. I'm delighted to welcome two guests from the University of Essex's distinguished Department of Sociology, Colin Sampson and Carlos Jigu. Thanks so much. You've both worked with Indigenous people in many parts of the world. You've seen destruction of lives and communities, and at the same time, the emergence of strength, activism, declarations of rights. How do things look today to you, Colin?
Well, it's a mixed bag, obviously. there are some very positive signs, and there are continuing erosions of Indigenous ways of life. It depends really where we're talking about. If I think about the two places that are most familiar to me in recent times, that would be Northern Labrador, working with the Innu, and the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, where I accompanied students there to the Standing Rock demonstration. Wind River, there are continuing difficulties over a number of issues, but there's also challenges that they're making to the courts to retain some of their land, and that there are other positive developments there. With the Innu, there is a continuing attachment to the land, and that's really, really vital, despite the dispossession that I think is incurred by the Canadian land claims process.
Great. Carlos, what about you?
Well, I think overall I can say that the picture is very grim. I cannot give a sign of hope when things are very difficult on the ground. But within the context that we're going to explain later, what are the characteristics of the grim picture, I think two things stand out in terms of Indigenous people's resilience. One is the capacity they have to mobilize themselves and to fight for their collective rights in processes that are led by themselves, where they find allies, either in international organizations or in local associations, but basically they take the initiative to fight for the rights themselves. And the second thing is the vital process of cultural revitalization that is happening everywhere, where Indigenous people are reclaiming back their own cultural identities in very creative ways. And I have seen this very much in South America, also in the South Pacific, Taiwan, and Japan. Mm.
Okay, well, I'll come to some examples of that in a moment. Let's go back to the Innu of Labrador, Colin, where you've worked for 20 years. Could you just tell us a little bit about what happened when they were forcibly settled from the 1960s? They were one of the latest groups to be, as it were, kind of settled into modern world. What kind of happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. So after the Canadian government coerced the Innu people to settle in villages and abandon their migratory way of life, there was the upsurge in alcoholism, upsurge in trauma, upsurge in suicides that had not been known when people were migratory hunters. The local Newfoundland government also criminalized hunting of caribou, and caribou was central, as you know, to the Innu way of life. So there was a period of about 20 or 30 years where the Innu were basically in shock, and I think they're just coming out of that now.
And so we've recently heard a lot about the discoveries of something that lots of people knew about for a long time, children buried in boarding schools, and the appalling nature of that. That was something that affected the Innu people as well, the forcible removal of children to schools. In order, why did, from the Canadian government's point of view, why were they doing that to these different people within the country?
Yeah, absolutely. The Canadian government did that in order to, in their own words, civilize Native American children. And they believed that their own ways of life were backward and superstitious and had no place in a rapidly modernizing society. So they extracted children from their families, from their parents, sometimes very, very young, and often those children never came back. And the incident you're talking about, which came to light, I think, in 2021 in May, involved the discovery of 300 or so bodies in a boarding school. That was the reason. Fortunately, this process did not affect the Innu as much as it did other people in Canada. The schools that were imposed upon them were in the communities. They were still traumatized by them, but it was different. Mm.
So there was an effort, back to your point, Carlos, about cultural revitalization. There was this range of processes that were about convergence of ways towards what happens to be characteristic of modern industrialized countries, a convergence into one way of living rather than permitting the kind of divergence. So if we could come back to that a bit, but tell us a little bit, Carlos, about the Selknam people of Tierra del Fuego. You've written about them and the, again, a kind of recent process is still, as it were, continuing to affect their lives. The southern tip of South America.
Well, one of the things, and this complements what Colin just said very nicely, is that Colin is referring to processes of settlement and resettlement in Canada that are very contemporary. I wrote a piece about the Chelman people in Tierra del Fuego, that is the southernmost island archipelago south of Patagonia in South America. And one of the things that I wrote about was the process of settler colonialism that endured there, by which the state took no responsibility over indigenous people's welfare, and by allowing settlers to move into those territories in order to introduce sheep farming or gold mining, then indigenous people were either massacred, killed, or displaced and removed. Sometimes they were removed to Christian missions because missionaries wanted to protect them against the violence of settlers, but those Christian missions became themselves a place for death because of epidemic diseases. And what I highlight about this article that I wrote is that it really acts as a reminder of the consequences of displacement and settler colonialism that remains something very much today in the world.
I think this also illustrates the importance for us all of recognizing the plurality of human knowledges. And the policies that I've been talking about and Carlos has been talking about, such as forced assimilation, forced settlement, and forced schooling, are ways of imposing one monolithic view upon everyone. And as we know, that is not a good thing for the world.
And let's pick up on that a little bit then. The 100,000 years-ish of modern human evolution, cultures across the world have had diverged according to local circumstances, whether you're in a desert or an island near the Antarctic, mountains, forests, plains. So that divergence has produced the diversity of culture, but also story, which I'd like to come to in a minute. How do people tell stories, and how do we then understand the kind of life ways that people have? And yet, at the same time, we've seen this convergence. Have we seen support for divergence now, allowing, as it were, that space? Not that people should be allowed it. They should just have the institutional and political space to carry that on. But have we seen that kind of support for divergence start to occur?
Yes, I believe we have, actually. And I put a lot of faith in the younger generations all around the world. And I see with my own students here at the University of Essex that there is a tremendous interest in Indigenous people. There's a tremendous interest in knowing about different kinds of worldviews and different sorts of wisdom and different ways of relating to nature. I think it's also, there's also, as Carlos mentioned, a massive global cultural revitalization movement. And part of that is to regenerate indigenous languages. And of course, these languages also encode different ways of knowing about the environment, about knowing about the relationship between humans and the environment and the cosmos and stories, etc. And so I think all this is very positive and very important.
One of the examples for that will be Taiwan. There are 16 indigenous recognized tribes in Taiwan, and it's extraordinary the capacity that indigenous people in Taiwan have had throughout centuries in order to protect their identities, their languages, and cultures. And today in Taiwan, there's been a big movement, for example, led by indigenous artists or indigenous curators, in order to showcase their identities in a very contemporary way, in dialogue with the past, acknowledging the context of colonialism and destruction that always engulfs them, but at the same time being very propositive towards the future. And that's very exciting.
So how have those sort of stories started to emerge? Have people helped them? Have people been able to use traditional storytelling methods as well as modern technologies? How are those kind of connecting up?
Well, I think there are two things there that I will say. Colin can follow on this. The first one is to remember that indigenous people have themselves kept the patrimony of their cultures within their communities despite the odds. So they have never disappeared completely. So it's not that an external agent came and helped them recover something they lost. No, they haven't lost it. They kept it. What has happened is that in some countries, because of a greater national consciousness and policies, there have been some support, for example, by indigenous laws or indigenous funds, a state sponsor, that allows indigenous people to develop their cultures and their communities in a more active and valuable way.
Well, a welcome to Robin Hanbury-Tennyson, writer, explorer, storyteller and photographer, president and co-founder of the Survival International Organization, chairman and president for 52 years. Robin, you first made a transcontinental journey across South America in 1958. If you did the same journey now, what do you think would have changed?
Well, most of the rainforest's gone. I mean, the size of the Amazon rainforest has halved since I made that journey through the middle of it. Hard to believe. And now the sort of route we took, which was along skirting the edge at times, is now all cleared, virtually all cleared, and is soybean from horizon to horizon. Terrible. And it was my first big expedition, and on that route we met several Indian tribes, including some uncontacted Shavanti. They were always wonderful, and it was interesting to meet them. Started a train of thought in my mind and that of my companion, Richard Mason, who was a doctor and who went back on a big expedition with John Hemming 3 years later, and was killed by an uncontacted group of Indians, which focused our minds on the fact that it wasn't their fault. They'd always had unfortunate contacts before, and there was no organization out there to represent them. And so we started what became Survival International.
And survival has played an important role for now something like 500 million indigenous people across the world, to keep that voice very, very kind of loud and heard. What kind of impacts do you think survival has had since you formed it half a century ago?
Oh, huge impacts. I mean, I always say that the sort of most simple, frivolous one is that I doubt there's a primary school anywhere in the world now that doesn't have a picture of a South American Indian on the wall, drawn by a five-year-old. And it's now part of the human psyche that that tribal people know and understand nature better than we do. And I think that's our greatest achievement. But of course, we've always handed over to people themselves to run their organizations. We don't try our hardest not to be seen as paternalistic people telling them to live in human zoos or anything like that, the usual canards that get thrown at us. And now South America is full of very active and feisty indigenous organizations who've been doing a brilliant job up until recently, when terrible people like Bolsonaro have been setting everything back 50 years, literally.
So you've written a wonderful new book called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, Pestilence, War, Famine and Death. And it was published exactly a month before the first lockdown in 2020. Very prescient indeed. When you look at indigenous people and cultures, do you draw hope from current circumstances? And that activism that you mentioned, the kind of knowledge and the capabilities that have grown across the world?
Well, it's a sort of two-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, one, of course, draws hope from their knowledge and their wisdom. And there have been a plethora of wonderful books over the last year during the COVID time, which I've been reading avidly, all about indigenous knowledge and wisdom and understanding of how nature actually interacts with life. And some wonderful books written by top scientists who happen to come from indigenous origins, blending the indigenous knowledge with top scientific information. And that has been very exciting. But the other side of the two-edged sword has been that we have seen the complete collapse of many environments and ecosystems in spite of people having lived there for thousands of years and managing their environment perfectly sustainably. We have done so much damage in the last 100 or 2 years that the planet is in severe jeopardy as a result. And it was a kind of irony writing that book, because it was all the basis of research. But I was putting forward tentative ideas of how to avoid the apocalyptic things we're facing on this planet from the Four Horsemen. And the first one, which pandemics, which is pestilence in the Bible, I have on the cover. And actually on page 4, I say there is about to be an imminent pandemic, which was kind of Nostradamus-y of me. But it blew me a month later. I became the first person really to go down very badly with COVID and be extremely ill and in a coma for 5 weeks. And they kept sending messages saying I wasn't going to come out of it. And if I did, I'd be severely brain damaged. And miraculously, I actually survived. And the trigger that got me out of the coma was being wheeled into a healing garden, because I happened to be in the only hospital in Britain that had one, associated with an ICU unit.
Isn't that wonderful? That nature then intervened to bring you back into the world.
Well, being wheeled out, feeling the sun on my face and smelling the flowers in a healing garden from that ghastly intensive care unit where poor old nurses have a horrible time as well, has made me evangelical about saying that every hospital in the country which has an ICU unit should have a healing garden in it, because we all know, and we're suddenly realizing just how powerful the healing power of nature is.
Absolutely. And when you were early in the book, you described being at the top of one of the temples of the giant jaguar at Calakmul, which is also known as Tikal, part of the Mayan civilization. And you wrote that you were there and saying, I'm angry, looking out at this gorgeous rainforest and the reminder of how people have lived and can live close to nature. Is that the kind of the top message that you would want to get across as we think about what needs to be done in the 2020s? Think about the importance of nature, think about the importance of cultures and indigenous people and what we can learn from those relationships.
Yes, it was a kind of Damascene moment at the top of that temple. The theme that runs through the book is that all civilizations die out after about 500 years. And the Maya are a particularly sharp example of that, which I use throughout the book. And they quite clearly died out, for me, as a result of overexploiting their environment. And in the past, we've always been able to move on to somewhere else, because it's a big planet and lots of wilderness areas. That's no longer the case. We've now used up all the available places to move. And mad ideas like moving to Mars, like Musk has at the moment, seem to me completely insane. I don't want to live in a spacesuit for the rest of my life in some ghastly, hostile environment. This planet, we are beginning to realize, is just so rich and so unique and so fantastic that that's where exploration and research should be devoted. Every penny of research should be going into understanding why it is and trying to get our heads around the fact that every teaspoon of Earth has more life forms in it than there are people on the planet. Get your head around that and you start understanding just how rich and fantastic this planet is.
Well, could you tell us the story of the young lad giant in Innu territory? I mean, he was one of a number of people who had been on the wrong end of all sorts of kind of personal difficulties and community ones, as you've described, that have come from settlement. And yet there are kind of emerged an opportunity to celebrate culture through a long walk, a kind of, you know, an echo of the Trail of Tears and people walking across landscapes and in order to determine their identity. And they used modern technology to stay in touch with people who couldn't go on the walk.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So Giant was a young Innu man, or is still youngish now, Innu man who decided that the life that the Canadian government had made for the Innu in the settlement was highly unsatisfactory and dysfunctional. And one of the things that he realized was that the connections to the land were absolutely vital to the Innu people. So he decided to go on a walk that he would lead that would circumnavigate the entirety of the Innu territories of the provinces of Labrador and Quebec in Canada. And he took this in three or four segments of about 400 kilometers each segment. And along the way, he picked up people in the different Inuit communities, and they went along with him on this walk. And one of the things that he was actually trying to draw attention to was the importance of maintaining the Inuit diet, which is a wild food diet, because one of the biggest problems in the communities is diabetes and heart disease and cancer, which are heavily diet related and related to the rapid shift from a wild food diet to a junk food diet. So it was an attempt to sort of bring back something that had, you know, been partially discarded from the past and reinvigorate it through the walk. And it gained a lot of publicity. There was a lot of media coverage. Giant himself was using all kinds of different telecommunications technologies and satellite phones. And there was a book written about it as well at the end.
And so people could watch that walk, even though they couldn't go on it. They could look at the social media and see where they were and to feel a kind of communal sense of pride about this reconnection with the land. Is that what was happening?
Absolutely.
And Carlos, examples of that sort of thing from your experience?
Well, we have a very good example here in Essex. A very good friend of mine, Byung, who did his PhD in curatorial practice in the Department of Art History here in Essex. He belongs to one of indigenous communities in Taiwan. He came to study to Essex, his PhD in curatorial practice, and what he did throughout his work was a critical reflection on indigenous cultures in Taiwan by organizing an exhibition in London. That was the ultimate part of the PhD, where he brought a number of different artists and performers from Taiwan, and basically it was a really fascinating experience because this is an indigenous young man who's an indigenous curator, who studied a PhD in a British university, who uses all of this in order to highlight and strengthen the claims for the rights of indigenous people in Taiwan through art. So it was a fascinating thing. And Byung is doing a fantastic job in Taiwan as we speak.
Well, if we went up a level from these kind of specifics on the ground of individual actions to rights and power, Nunavut is a province in Canada that has political power for Inuit people, not the Innu, as we've been talking about, a different group. Tuva in Russia has indigenous people, a republic within Russia, who are the political leaders within the republic. Sikkim in India, Bhutan, a whole country, individual sovereign reservations in the US, you could argue, are also kind of much smaller examples of where power is held by indigenous people and cultures, even if they're set within a different set of structures, which might make it really difficult. For example, resourcing is always an issue. What hope is there now for this decade when we start to think about the kind of the power that sits within communities? When Bjorn goes back to Thailand, how are they able to marshal institutions and political support to make sure there's the space for indigenous people? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's difficult, Jules, because, as you say, these indigenous territories are encased within a larger sovereignty. So there are limits. Even with Nunavut, as long as the Inuit are the majority in Nunavut, they're fine. They can control it. But if there's a big mine that opens up and lots of non-indigenous people settle there, then they may lose that power. But I think the momentum is going in their direction. The momentum is towards indigenous control of these territories. And, you know, just to use the Nunavut example, one of the interesting developments there is this incredible production company called Izuma Productions, which made the prize-winning film Atan Arjuit, The Fast Runner. And they have created something called Indigenous Digital Democracy. And what they're trying to do actually is say that there can be many alternative futures for the Inuit. And one of them could be in filmmaking. One of them could be doing this instead of, for example, an extractive industry.
So filmmaking may be a part of the answer.
In Latin America and in many places in the South Pacific, there are many indigenous film festivals, for example. And this has been a very important medium of expression of something that is very fundamental to all indigenous communities, and that is their collective rights to the lands, territories, and resources. There is not one single indigenous film that doesn't touch on this. This is a starting point for any expression of their own knowledge. And the second thing that is important of these films is about portraying who they are And this is interesting because it's not only about portraying who they are for external audiences. It also acts as a catalyst to to themselves, especially for the younger generations. So, for example, I've been in the Amazon, where I've been in a place where there is no electricity and there is a generator, you know, and the people sitting on the football field or on a savanna looking at the screen, you know, being portrayed as a history about storytelling in their own community. And it's beautiful and moving when you see the children learning from their elders through the screen. And this is happens in many, many places. And this is a way of reclaiming knowledge, and also it's a way of reclaiming their identities on the face of big challenges.
So that kind of just a communal screening of a film that celebrates identity and strength could be a prompt to very significant change, as important change as an international declaration, as a change in policy, because it's giving people something to believe in. Is that, and hope, perhaps?
They go side by side, because I think, and taking one step back in order to come back to this, we need to understand what colonialism actually is. And in a nutshell, colonialism is two things. One is direct control over other people, and that can be through the use of force or the threat of force. The other way is by imposing epistemologies and knowledge over other people, representations of otherness over others, what social anthropology did for a long time in basically defining who others are. And indigenous people are fighting back in two ways against those two elements of colonialism. One is by reaffirming their self-determination against power, and the second one is about rescuing their own epistemologies, creating their own knowledge in order to fight the stereotypes and stigmas attached to them for such a long period of time.
So when we hear characterizations of what are called in the UK Generation Z, so the young people born from 1995 to 2012-ish, the kinds of people who are students in universities at the moment, they are much more active. They're much more likely to work together to solve problems. They're much more concerned about the planet. They're much more likely to be vegetarian, not smoke, not take drugs, and yet are much more vulnerable because of the connectivity of kind of social media. So something comes on the back of that. But I think one of the things that comes to me is the readiness for activism and action. And that was something that we saw at the COP in Glasgow with Indigenous people and their voices, and also lots of young voices, not necessarily Indigenous, but others concerned about the future of the planet. So if there's an unlocking of young voices and activism within Indigenous communities, that could join up with the kind of activism and interest in young people in many parts of the world. After all, they're going to be old people at some point and they'll be in charge.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think you really raise a good point there. Young people among Indigenous communities are really taking the lead. But this is important to understand that they don't do it in contradiction to the elders, because they do respect the elders. They build their knowledge from the elders. Is they just develop new strategies and new mediums attached to what is effective today. So it's really important that it's not that the young Indigenous leaders are fighting the elders, because it doesn't work that way. They're building on the elders' resilience, they're building on the elders' knowledge in order to develop new strategies today. And they're very active doing so.
I think this issue is very important about the youth. It's not just the Indigenous youth that are taking the lead. I think it's also non-Indigenous youth. And one of my favorite photographs is one that was taken about 2 years ago of Greta Thunberg visiting the Standing Rock Reservation, in which a Standing Rock chief in full war bonnet, looms over her. And you can see the mutual admiration in their eyes. The photograph actually conveys that. And I think that the 2016, 2017 Standing Rock oil pipeline protest brought together lots of non-Indigenous people to support Indigenous people in alliance with one another. And I think that has had a huge global effect, because there were people from all over the world that were involved in that.
So welcome to Julian Berger, visiting professor at the Human Rights Centre here at the University of Essex. Welcome, Julian. You've helped co-curate a gorgeous exhibition in Geneva on environmental injustice running through till August 2022. Could you just tell us a little bit about that exhibition and what you hope to achieve with it?
Well, it's an exhibition which, of course, suffered in its preparation with all the COVID. So it's had a lot of difficulties, and it took a longer time to get it together. But essentially, It contains a number of messages. Most importantly, that indigenous people are a 21st century people, so they're not the remnants of something. And we feel very strongly, and that was my approach in discussing it with museums, and finally the Geneva Ethnographic Museum. We want to get away from this image that everything is kind of baskets and pots from a long time ago. These are people contesting, resisting different kinds of impositions on their land. There are people fighting for their rights. There are people suffering. There are also people who are living in this century, have answers to some of the challenges of this century. So the exhibition, in one way, is it has this element of negative and positive. Negative, in the sense, tries to bring to young people particularly the story of how our resource development, our acquisition for resources, whether it's through mining, hydro, oil, gas, and so on, is having enormous impacts and has enormous impacts on indigenous peoples all over the world, disproportionately. But at the same time, the indigenous people are not sitting passively doing nothing. They are fighting back. They have been extremely successful in many ways, and they have a specific knowledge that allows us to protect that environment. So the exhibition was trying to tell a positive story. Yes, there are many difficulties faced by indigenous people in the area of climate, of course, greatly impacted by deforestation, the global warming, loss of pasture lands, and so on and so forth. So yes, they're suffering, but they've also got an incredible local knowledge, indigenous knowledge, which helps them to mitigate and adapt, and obviously can help us in our struggle to combat global warming.
So there are beautiful objects, photographs, installations, as you say, contemporary ones produced by young artists and indigenous activists from across the world. That kind of range of storytelling, do you think that, how does that help them to understand their own circumstances, but also tell others about what they know and what they can do, and indeed a kind of larger sort of normative project about what the world should be doing as a result of that kind of knowledge and capability?
Well, I mean, the idea was to give voice, and that's also quite an important aspect of the exhibition. Initially, we wanted to adopt a policy of what we call free, prior, and informed consent. This is a principle that indigenous people fought for at the United Nations in the declaration, which was adopted 2007, some time ago, and the museum needs to respect that too. So the idea was to develop the exhibition with indigenous people and allow them and give them the opportunity to provide content and to reflect on it. And of course, one of the aspects is to give voice to as many indigenous people as we can, and there are about 25 or so short interviews with people from all over the world. So that is important, and these are short interviews, so they're in the form of storytelling, why it's important, and so on.
Wonderful. And you helped with many people to produce and draft the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as you've just mentioned, in 2007. Has that helped to frame thinking at that kind of international level, to give space to the voices that you've mentioned, to give space to the stories? Sometimes international treaties are signed and forgotten about, and sometimes they are quite determinative of at least a new way of thinking, if not yet a new way of acting. But do you think it's had some positive impact in the last 14 years?
Well, I sort of have to, having spent a couple of decades in rooms where there were people struggling to get the rights recognized. But I think in several ways. First of all, it's a kind of unusual declaration in the UN, because, as you probably know, UN does its treaty preparation and treaties usually with governments, and not many other people around, as we can see from the COP 26, where it's basically governments that sit together, and of course some bankers and mining corporations as well. But essentially, these are events where governments decide and there are no others present. In this case, it was different. Here, the beneficiaries were the indigenous people, and they were absolutely present. And what has that meant? It's meant that they feel ownership of this declaration, and they know it very well. And indigenous people know things about free, prior, and informed consent, which is a key principle. They know they have a right of self-determination. They know they have a right to their traditional lands, their resources, and so forth. This has permeated indigenous peoples right through. So the declaration is a bit different from many other treaties, which we are not familiar with. It's become part of their language. So in that sense, yes. And secondly, I think, it has given tremendous space for indigenous people internationally. They have a kind of right to be there and able to participate. And you can see that with all the difficulties of the COP26, indigenous people were very present. Those scientists who are part of that process were very recognizing very clearly indigenous people's role in protecting biodiversity and contributing to mitigating global warming and so forth. So there is a real recognition, and that work internationally is something that's been built up since the 1980s, because they've been coming, infiltrating, I would say almost like, something almost the opposite of Christopher Columbus, you know, who discovered the Americas. These guys have gone into the UN and discovered the UN and spread their work, their voice and their perspectives right through the UN system, the international system, including biodiversity, climate change, and so forth. So they've been a real strong presence.
So if we were talking about the kind of top priorities, let's come to a kind of conclusion on that, for 500 million indigenous people, I think you could also say, I know, Carlos, you've worked locally with migrants and refugee communities here in North Essex, 280 million migrants and refugees across the world, 500 million indigenous people, that together that's 10% of the world population who are seeking the space just to live. And that's what we've been hearing about today. So if you're kind of looking forward from here, on the analysis of the kind of grim situation for many, is there space for kindness and generosity of spirit? Do you see there are opportunities for better things to start to happen? Or does it still feel... I think both these things sit side by side. For a lot of people, it still feels bad. But the question is, I suppose, is there hope?
There is absolute hope. Well, you, Colin, myself, we all have been guests to indigenous communities. We have indigenous friends. The level of love, care, support, understanding, empathy with every time I've been in any indigenous community is beyond what I can ever find in a city, in an urban space. This is extraordinary. They don't see you as a threat. They see you as a friend, and they treat you as such. They treat you as a brother. And that is really moving, because it really helps you to understand that if you work with indigenous communities, if you're serious about trying to understand where they're coming from and embrace what they fight for, then that's a big sign of hope, because you can create alliances between an academic and an indigenous community, everybody knowing how we can contribute towards that.
Yeah, I would just add one point to that, which is one of the values that indigenous people hold dear, or many of them hold dear, is sharing. Indigenous peoples would not have survived as long as they have had they not have spread out their resources among their groups, you know, evenly, rather than emphasizing individual private property and profit and things like that. So I think we also really need to take that into account very seriously.
Thank you very much. There is, after all, only the one planet with a hard border. We're all on it. We're all connected. And sharing is togetherness is what's brought us to this point. Thank you very much indeed to both of you.
Thank you. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information, and do rate the pod if you can.